Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Look, Karen called happily to 20-month-old Dara. We're at the beach. See the waves? Let's get your sandals off and we can go for a walk in the sand. Karen put down her bag, spread out the beach towel, and plopped Dara down in the center. Dara looked around, fascinated with the crashing waves and the swooping gulls with their shrill cries. She worked at the straps of her sandals without success. Oof, she grunted. Oof! Yes, yes, replied Karen. We'll get them off. We need to unbuckle them first. And she opened the buckles and slid her daughter's tiny feet out of her shoes. Let's take your bucket and shovel with us, Karen suggested. Then we can dig in the sand. Go! Squealed Dara as she carefully got to her feet. She took Karen's hand as she waddled off the beach blanket. Her next sound was a distressed shriek as her feet touched the sand for the first time. She stopped in her tracks and worked frantically, kicking and trying to knock the sand off her feet. No, no, she wailed. No, no. From a parent's perspective, what should we know about sensory stimulation, and how can we make it into an enriching experience? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest has been working with issues like those in this story for many years. Lynn C. Israel has been practicing occupational therapy since 1968. She approaches treatment not only as a master clinician, but also from a practical aspect as a parent. She worked in Fairfax County, Virginia Public Schools and at the Lab School of Washington prior to opening her own practice. Since 1977, Lynn C. Israel & Associates, Incorporated has offered occupational therapy to preschoolers and school-aged children. Lynn C. Israel & Associates also work at the Kingsbury Day School in Washington, D.C., and the Oakwood School in Virginia. Lynn has three grown daughters. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Lynn.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here. It's quite a pleasure.
Experts say sensory motor play is important in a child's development. Why?
Well, Sandy's story talked about one aspect of sensory processing. And what she was relating to with the sand is a child's discomfort with certain kinds of touch information. And that's part of the sensory system. That's a real issue for some children. Some children don't like tags in their clothes. The feel of things are very difficult for them to accommodate. They attend to those all the time. It's different when we put on clothes and might feel itchy at first, but then you accommodate to that sense of touch. But some children are hypersensitive to things and they can't tolerate that. So that interferes with their daily lives. But when we talk about sensory motor play or sensory motor development, we're really talking about the variety of senses and how they interact. I would say those senses are the foundations for development. Those are the things that make meaning out of our lives. When we touch something, we feel how hard or soft it is. When we move our bodies, we feel how far we move our arm or how we place our hand to pick up a cup or to pick up a pencil. So the senses are the meaning.
Are kids more hypersensitive at young ages to touch than they are as they get older? We sort of think of little ones as learning, you know, don't touch the hot stove. They have to touch everything. They have to put everything in their mouths. Is that a hypersensitive state they're in?
That's a part of learning. It's not necessarily a hypersensitive state, but it's they don't have the background knowledge that they're getting. They're acquiring knowledge through that kind of information. So they have to touch it. If they have to feel what hot is, we've already experienced that. So once a child touches a hot stove, then that information is usually retained. So they know not to touch it again. So it's not necessarily hypersensitive, but they are curious because they don't have the knowledge base to let you know or to tell what that information is about.
I watched my little 11-month-old granddaughter touch a cat for the first time a few weeks ago, and she knew what it was. She'd seen cats out the window of their house, or two cats that climb the tree all the time out there, but she had never been close to a cat, and this is a very thick, furry cat. He's a very funny animal, very gentle. So she reached out and she touched with one finger. It was very, very cute, this big fluffy thing. And then she grabbed a handful of that fur. The cat was not happy. He didn't scratch her. He just quietly got up and moved away. And of course, we moved her away and we said, make nice And eventually she was doing what we asked her to do. She wasn't afraid of the feeling, but it was so interesting to watch her discover what that felt like the first time.
And that's the information gathering that we typically store.
Now, do kids get enough in their normal day-to-day play, or is it important that parents provide extra stimulation of some kind?
Now, that's a great question, because normal play is something that, how do you describe what normal play is? In areas of the country where kids can still roam on their own and experience things without supervision, normal play provides a lot more stimulation and a lot more information than in our cities where children have to be supervised at all times. When you think about the olden days, and of course our kids hate us to refer to the olden days, but we walked to school. We rode our bikes to school. We skated to school. Now in the cities, it's not safe to do that. So we drive our children, we put them in the car, and we watch them on the playground even. So they are not privy to take the kinds of risks that children in other areas or in the olden days were able to do. When I was a kid, I was climbing up walls to get to the park. We ran around and played in the park all day long, climbed trees. I even jumped off the roof of my garage one time. No vigilant parent would ever allow a kid to do that kind of thing. So when we talk about normal play, I would say go take a few steps back. Get kids involved in things like kick the can and some of the activities that we used to do that allow more room for exploration, development, and so forth.
If you have a child who would rather sit and read or play board games all day, would you say he's being a little bit deprived of sensory experiences?
Yes, because they're different systems. You learn a lot through reading, obviously, but to attach meaning to all of that information, the motor piece is very important.
Just like, I guess, the old business about you can see a picture of an apple, but unless you've held an apple or smelled an apple or eaten an apple, you really don't know what it is.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. So I guess all of you parents who've had your child jumping from roofs of garages or other things, I guess we have to say, well, there's some benefit in that.
Well, I say, if you're in a city like Washington, D.C., where we are, or New York, or any large city where you have a confined environment, it's really important to get your kids outside, but it's also important to let them do things inside that maybe you wouldn't think is okay. For example, jumping on the beds, or crawling around on the furniture, using a little mini trampoline, some of things like that, to allow them to have access to more motor experiences.
Or the dreaded finger paints.
Oh, yes. Think about when we used to play in the mud. We made mud pies. That was just acceptable. Kids just went outside and did that. You'd come inside, you'd be all muddy, and you'd change your clothes. No big deal. I don't know any kids that play in mud pies nowadays.
Although we had a very enterprising engineer who made a lovely canal in our backyard, and that was definitely a mud hole. We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on sensory-motor integration.
Washington, D.C. with Kids, an excellent book by authors Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking with Lindsay Israel about sensory-motor integration for children.
Lynn, how is the body's visual system connected with a child's sensory-motor issues?
Vision is a tricky word as well. There are so many different aspects of vision. And I think we take vision as visual acuity. Do our eyes work? Are they healthy? Can they actually see? But vision is so much more complex than that. There are various aspects of vision, like visual memory, attaching meaning to different objects or what we see. That's all a part of it. We talk about visual spatial perception. We talk about nearsightedness, farsightedness, binocular vision. That's using the eyes together to focus. But when we're talking about it in relationship to the motor system, the visual system gives information to the brain. Part of that information goes to the posterior parietal lobe, where it interacts with the sensory systems, and it's directly sent to the motor system. So that kind of information gives us information about how far to move our arm to pick up the glass of water that's sitting here on the table, or how to pick up that pencil and position it accurately in my hand. So the visual system gives the guidance, integrates with the sensory system to enable us to move smoothly and efficiently and automatically.
Do some children not have that connection that you mentioned in the brain, so that what they're seeing visually they can't make happen with their hand or their leg?
Certainly. I think the children that have autism have a great deal of difficulty with that. That attaching meaning is very difficult. Not everyone is born with the ability to integrate that. When you see children that are struggling with things like maybe handwriting or their motor development, they may need some extra development there. It doesn't happen automatically. We have a feedback system in the brain that gives us information about whether we're doing things correctly or not. But for some children, that feedback system is faulty. It's not giving them the correct information because the sensory systems may not be well developed or well enough developed to give them that information. They may need help developing those systems to be able to give the appropriate feedback.
And you can get a reality check with what's normal and what's not by watching a child on the playground, for example, and seeing how he or she does physical activities in comparison to the other kids. Would that be a clue?
That's a good clue. That's often a red flag. Often I'll get called into a school to say the teachers aren't sure, but they see the issues on the playground, or they might see issues in handwriting or something that has to do with motor development in the classroom. And they'll say, take a look at this child, and you can pick up a lot on the playground. Well, I think that it's important to talk about the visual system a little bit more, in that there are a couple huge aspects of that, in that vision is, there are two parts of that system. There are what and the where. The what part of that system gives you information about the qualities of that, size, shape, hardness, so that you know, you recognize the object. You create images in your mind, in your mind's eye, about those objects. And some children are very good at that and don't have, they may have sensory motor problems, but they can actually have the good perception of the mind's eye, so that they image that kind of information. So they may be very good at visual perceptual or visual spatial skills. The where part of the system is the system that I mentioned earlier that relates to the sensory motor, where those things all come together to give you information as to how far to move your hand or how high to move your foot. And those actually have different pathways in the brain. There are some similarities in the transmission of those to the brain, but there are also some different pathways.
You talked before about binocular vision. How do you know, especially I guess with reading, it comes out in school and everything, how do you know if your child could have 20/20 vision but not good binocular vision?
The binocular vision is really the end product that we see. Binocular vision is usually the end result of good coordination of both sides of the body, and that starts in the brain with the brain interacting. I think it's usually detected when a child's having some trouble. So then we go and get an expert. The developmental optometrist will tell you that every child should have that kind of an evaluation, not just an evaluation for acuity, which is done by the ophthalmologists, but also to check out the visual perceptual skills, the visual spatial skills, and the binocular vision.
Now, what about activities that would stimulate a child's visual system? Are there things that parents can do, especially when they can take a child outdoors?
We're stimulating the visual system all the time. When you ask a question about outdoors, I would say it's important that kids be outdoors all the time, not just in the nice weather, but they experience different things in the cold. Games like Angels in the Snow, sledding gives that information. Movement gives information to the visual system that helps it integrate with the sensory motor system that makes movement more accurate, coordinated, and efficient. Now, take, for example, walking upstairs. I think that's an easy one to relate to. When we look at a flight of stairs, we automatically adjust our step to that height of the stairs. We don't have to look to place our foot at that point. That's the way the visual system interacts with the motor system. It automatically gives messages through the brain to the body to tell you how high to lift your foot. And if you've ever walked on uneven stairs, then that visual system kicks in much more readily and more frequently because you're relying on that to adjust the height. You can't just do it at an automatic level.
Do you sometimes see kids who can't do that? Going upstairs is a difficult task to learn?
Yes, definitely. And I think some of the kids, when you see kids that don't alternate stairs after age 6, certainly, maybe a little earlier even, some of those kids may be having trouble with the spatial information or with using both sides of their body together in a coordinated way.
We always hear about children who tune out, and they especially tune out our voices, of course. We've all known that. But what is significant about our stimulating this auditory system for them? Any suggestions?
Well, first, tuning out is a good thing.
We're not going to tell this to our children, everyone.
Just think, if we didn't tune out information coming in, we're bombarded with noise. We've got the TV going, the radio going, the computer sounds, voices. So we need to learn to tune out information and be able to attend to appropriate information. So we have some children that are unable to tune out, and those are children who are usually highly distractible. We've got to help them be able to do that. So when you say stimulate the system, I would say in many cases it's really dampening the system, being able to help the children differentiate. Now, we can do that. We can help our children by speaking in softer voices, by looking them in the eye, by giving them a touch cue, maybe tap them on the shoulder, get down to make sure that they have that information. Think about, we tune out our kids a lot. I get accused of that.
Oh, yes. Any parent gets accused of that.
Especially with a house full of teenagers. But you think about when kids are yelling down the stairs, they want something. You know that they're, you know, Mom.
They want it right now.
I want this now, and I want you to do it, and I want you to be there. Well, we can choose to run, or we can choose to ignore that. Kids have learned that, too. When we're yapping at our kids, they don't want to have any part of it because they don't want that demand. So they'll often tune out. Now, if it's pathological, I mean, if the child really doesn't get the cues and can't attend, then that's a different issue. And that's when intervention is important. That's beyond what we do in our practice. That's really a speech and language issue rather than an occupational therapy issue.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on sensory-motor integration.
For an audio CD of Any Parent's Perspective show, send a check or money order for $10 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Lynn C. Israel about sensory motor integration for children.
What about our sense of movement? What would you say is the difference between that system and the system that helps a child orient his body in space?
The system that helps a child orient the body in space relates to movement. That is the internal awareness of how our muscles and joints move. And it gives us information as to where our bodies are in space so that we know where our arm is. If our arm is out with our eyes closed, we don't have to look at it to know where it is. That's that sense. So that's important in our sense of movement because it gives us information about where our bodies are. I saw a flight attendant the other day walking down the aisle. You know, the planes today are much smaller. And so I was flying from Los Angeles to Washington, and the aisle was just wide enough for a thin person to walk down. So people's arms are hanging out over the edge and their legs are kind of hanging out. When she walked down the aisle, she automatically moved her body in a way. She rotated her hips so that she didn't touch people along the way.
Is there anything that parents should be doing to stimulate that sense of a child's body in space or his motor awareness?
Old-fashioned games. Things like kick the can, as I mentioned before, obstacle courses, climbing, jungle gyms, doing things with eyes closed. It's very important to not rely totally on vision. If you have difficulty with that, how do you navigate without the visual cues? Or to look at something, you get a sense of the distance or the space, and then to try to do that blindfolded.
How about doing things backwards? What does that do? Trying to walk backwards or do other things backwards?
Backwards is important. It gives you more awareness of the space behind. And math tutors have actually found that working with children in backwards space can increase their ability to do things like subtraction, because that is an abstract, backwards kind of information system. You have to understand what that's about to really get subtraction.
What do occupational therapists do to help people who can't do these things naturally?
We have all kinds of fun. Our office looks like a gym in a way. We have lots of special kinds of equipment that we use, various swings, and the swings will work in a way that make the body move automatically in the way that we would like to stimulate the system. So we may have an oblong swing that makes a child shift weight from one side to side to use both the sides of the body together in a coordinated way. We use scooter boards going down ramps to stimulate the system called the vestibular system that relates to movement and gravity. And that's a very important system in developing muscle tone, developing neck stability. We need good muscle tone and neck stability for good visual stability. And we might involve the children in obstacle courses where they have to negotiate space and find different things or avoid certain objects. We may have them go through tunnels so that they can get a perception of being inside and how do they negotiate outside. Also, we use a lot of activities that require timing and sequencing. And that's another very important part of being able to use the body automatically. And we may have them swing on a zip line or swing on a trapeze and then drop into a pile of inner tubes to try to hit just that right portion. When you talk about the visual integration there, you swing, you've got to see where you're going to drop and then try to let go at that point at just the right timing. And a lot of our kids have a lot of difficulty figuring that out.
Lynn, what resources would you suggest for our listeners who want to learn more about some of these issues?
I think the best book out for parents is The Out of Sync Child by Carol Kranowitz. She really put it in lay terms for parents to understand. There are a lot of technical books, but they're hard to get through. The follow-up book on that one is The Out of Sync Child Has Fun. And that gives a lot of activities for parents to use to develop these skills. Playground Politics by Dr. Stanley Greenspan is another good book. There are two websites that I would suggest. Kid Foundation, which is www.kidfoundation.org. That's a resource for parents for sensory motor information. There's a whole lot there. And there's an occupational therapy site. It's an occupational therapy practice in Boston called OTA Watertown, and they have a website. Another great source of information is the Developmental Delay Resources. They offer books, lots of information for parents.
Well, Lynn Israel, you have given a lot of information and resources for parents, and we're so glad you could be with us today. Thank you for coming.
Thank you so much. This is so nice to be here, be able to speak to parents.
Our gift for our first caller is a copy of the Little Book, written with the HSC Pediatric Center. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573. And please spell anything that's not obvious. Mention show number 264 and tell us, if you can, what station you're listening to. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know what station you're tuning into.
To learn more about Parents Perspective and our latest book, Washington, D.C. with Kids, visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org. That's www.parentsperspective.org. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents Perspective. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.